There we go. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Ann Hill, author of this book, What to Do When Dreams Go Bad, A Practical Guide to Nightmares. She is, in addition, a dream consultant and host of a weekly Dream Talk radio show on KOWS-FM in Occidental, co-author with Starhawk of Circle Round, Raising Children in Goddess Traditions, has contributed to the Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature, writes on dreams, spirituality, and culture for both the Huffington Post and the award-winning Blogonosis. She teaches internationally, lives on the Sonoma Coast, and is joining us here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out on a cold day. Oh my goodness! I was dropping my daughter off at Annalee. She's in the play coming up, and I thought, oh, I'll just go to Whole Foods. And I just thought, what is going on? I never can find a place to park anyway. But it was just, I couldn't figure out. And then I realized it was the tree lighting ceremony. So, a million babies. You have never seen so many babies. Adorable little things in the snuggly packs.
It's also dine out for charity tonight, too.
That's right.
So everybody's dining for charity.
Yeah, that's your percentage goes.
So,
food for thought.
Right, food for thought. Oh, well, thank you for coming here. I really appreciate your presence here. I've been thinking a lot about dreams and nightmares. First of all, I should ask, does anybody have any nightmares that are particularly present or came to the fore, as it were, and is why you're here tonight? Oh, okay. So a recent nightmare or just a chronic?
Recurring.
Okay, right. I was just talking on my radio show this morning. I interviewed, you might know this guy, William Harris. He is a Columbia professor who wrote this very erudite book on dreams and experience in classical antiquity. Mm-hmm. And I had been sitting with his book for 6 months thinking, oh God, I have to review it, I have to interview him, but he's going to kill me, you know? It's like somebody that's in his 70s and has been studying this and has such really set opinions about dreams. And so anyway, he was the loveliest man. We had a fabulous conversation. And what really struck me about his book is the questions that he chose to ask about dreams after a long career in history of that period, classical antiquity, so I know spanning the BC to AD arch by a millennia or two, so thereabouts. The questions that he wanted to answer that had really been bugging him all the time in his career were questions like, do people, can we trust what people say about their dreams? Or are they saying something but they're dreaming something else? And this struck me, what an odd question to ask of ancient Greek manuscripts. How could you possibly answer that? And what precipitated that? And so I had this little subtext of in my show, why are you asking these questions about dreams? It struck me as a meditation on one's own questions. This gentleman is in his 70s, I suppose, on these different questions. And the other question that he asked was, why do epiphany dreams not seem to occur in the Western world after this time period? And so we got into that towards the end, and of course that has raised the hackles of every dream worker that's heard of the book, because of course anybody who works with dreams knows that epiphany dreams happen all the time. You know, people, I just spoke with a woman, Stephanie down at Copperfields. Her sister had a dream out of nowhere, apropos of nothing, that was a clear voice saying, go back to school and get a master's in journalism. she had a job, she had a career, and there was this really, it was like one of those thunderbolt messages. And Stephanie was telling me about it, and she said, you know, my sister was complaining about this dream that was just so, it's so inconvenient, and Stephanie just told her, shut up! Everybody wants to have a dream that's that clear. You know, what are you complaining about? At least you've got a really strong dream. And so she actually did. She managed to find a master's program in Vancouver. Went up to Vancouver for 2 years and studied it. And now she's, I believe she's working for NPR as a something related to journalism. So who knows why these dreams come. So anyway, the idea of epiphany dreams and my conversation with William Harris this morning, turns out that he really had some dreams that he couldn't figure out, and he was just really frustrated by them. And not that this was the reduction of all of his questions, but this was part of it that we got to, is that he was saying, well, you know, I had this erotic dream the other night, and it was just sort of a garden variety erotic dream, if you can describe an erotic dream as garden variety. But, you know, it was just a typical erotic dream, except this woman had a waist that was uncommonly narrow, like in when you'd see when they had the whalebone corsets and the, you know, just really constricted. And he said, why that? Why that detail? Why that dream now? And that is just such a universal question about dreams. Why this dream? Why now? And so that kind of winds back to the topic of nightmares, because that's the type of dream that we wake up from, and amidst all the other fear and other thoughts that come up, there is some version of the question, why this dream and why now? So I thought about approaching the topic of the spiritual content of nightmares by starting with everything but the spiritual content. I mean, of course, you can't really separate out spirit. There's no scalpel that takes that out of the equation. But it's important to understand that nightmares have a lot of physical causes, and they have a lot of mental and emotional causes. And the more we are cognizant of that level of our dreaming life, the more any spiritual insights can be helpful, because we can approach everything from a sort of a holistic perspective. So the other thing Professor Harris was saying this morning was talking about his anxiety dreams. He says, why do I have an anxiety dream that's about losing my luggage on a train? I mean, I may be anxious about something, but I'm not anxious about losing my luggage on a train. So why does the dream have that? And my answer to him, of course, I wasn't really directly answering his question, but my feeling about anxiety dreams is that anxiety dreams are dreams in which, if any number of possibilities can occur at any given moment in the dream will choose the least pleasant one or the less pleasant one. If I'm at an intersection in my dream and I'm about to cross the street, and I'm at the point in the dream where I'm thinking, should I cross or should I stay? Something unpleasant will happen. Like maybe there's a car that comes and nearly hits me if I try and cross the street. Or if I stay, there's somebody who comes up and starts harassing me. You know, it's that kind of a dream. It could be a dream where I just pleasantly push the button, wait for the light, and go across. But instead, something else happens, and it kind of... it's a sort of a snowball effect, if you think about it, sometimes with anxiety dreams. You get rattled in the first encounter that's less than ideal, and then everything after that, you're just sort of rattled and off-center in the dream. So it's a particularly distressing kind of dream for me, because you know, my spiritual practice through Aikido is a centering practice. And I'm trying to, you know, the idea is that you practice something in waking life and then it bleeds over into your sleeping life. And then I'm being off center and thrown off balance and at a loss for words in a dream. And that's, I find that particularly irritating. So anxiety dreams, they seem to be particularly prevalent now. I'm hearing a lot of anxiety dreams from people, and I don't know whether, I mean, I think a lot of it is the economy. People are just, it's not an ideal time for business people or for unemployed people or partly employed people. I think there's a lot of jittery stuff going on, and that's causing some more troubling dreams. Or it's possible that the dreams were all just waiting there, and you know, when we have this veneer in our lives that everything's going fine, we don't really tap into our deeper fears. And then when things become unstable, somewhat unsettled in our waking lives, it's like there's a rift, there's a little earthquake, and some of the underlying issues in our lives can come up through our dreams. I hope that's not too obtuse for people. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I just went off into all of this sort of visual imagery around dreams, and she said, "You lost me at imagine a big rift in the ground." I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. So if at any point you have a question about anything that I'm saying, please, you know, yes.
Actually, I do.
Oh, great.
I'm just trying to keep my hard drive operating
yes,
properly.
Right.
You know, it seems useful for me, at least. If you would describe the difference between what maybe normal dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And what constitutes really a nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the sweating, waking up, you know.
Right.
Damp or
right.
bizarre thoughts, but really, where's the maybe the dividing line?
Well, it's largely subjective, but there are, and I should make a distinction between night terrors and nightmares. Night terrors are when you wake up generally earlier at night, and you get the pounding, heart pounding in the chest, the cold sweat, the you know, something terrifying has happened, and there's often not a dream narrative associated with it. It's often more of I can't remember what happened, or maybe you don't even realize that you're yelling in your sleep or kicking or flailing, and somebody has to wake you up. That's a night terror, whereas a nightmare tends to come later on, towards the end of the night, the early morning. And it tends to be very dream-based imagery. So whatever else there is attached to it, that there's a sort of a physiologic difference in terms of it comes with as you sleep, your REM cycles get progressively longer through the night, and so towards the end of the night and early morning, you have these long REM cycles, ideally. So and that's usually where the nightmares come from. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that seems okay. You call them night terrors. That sounds very Hollywood. You know, the guy comes up in bed, and he's sweating, his wife goes, "What happened?" And, you know, and there's, of course, it adds to the narrative of the movie or something.
Yeah.
And I feel I tend to think of those as the nightmares, the real terror. You know, because I'm always fascinated by, I want to meet the script writer for my dreams. Right. Because, you know, where are they getting the ideas for this imagery that I'm seeing?
Yeah.
You know? And but not all of it is really terrifying or horrible or dangerous or I mean, you know, some of it is disturbing somewhat, but you know, I'm confused. But is that a nightmare? And I'm trying to understand your definition there by that.
I think there's a continuum between anxiety dreams, which is just sort of unsettling dreams, or like, that was a little bit odd, why did that happen? And nightmares, where you wake up really frightened by something. I mean, genuinely, almost to the point of feeling like you're physically under attack by something or someone. There's been an intruder, that type of real sort of fight or flight kind of terror. So anxiety dreams would be, I'm at the bus station and I missed the bus, and then somebody grabs my bag and I'm trying to walk down the street and there's construction. I can't get to where I'm going and nobody will give me directions. That kind of anxiety thing, whereas a nightmare tends to, and nightmares can have really bizarre imagery. One of the categories, people try and figure this out all the time. Why do we have these strange images? And, one of the ways that dream researchers have tried to understand imagery is by doing these quantitative analyses of symbols, dream symbols. And so they talk about different qualities of dream symbols, and one of them is bizarreness. And just flying monkeys coming out of potholes in the ground. I mean, that would be sort of a bizarre, something that is out of the ordinary. So they have the scale of bizarreness, and typically nightmares have some of that higher levels of bizarreness in dream symbols. Yes?
So with night terror, it's starting to sound like what I'm having is night terrors, because I don't remember much about them. I'm like screaming really loud, and my husband usually wakes me up. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I say things where I'm like, my body's like running or something.
Right.
So it's pretty bizarre. It's been going on for a long time, lately it's been getting worse. Yeah. But the rest of my life is getting better. So.
Go figure.
And I have like sort of a background in dream work.
Yeah.
Where I worked with symbols and stuff, but I don't remember much about these. Mm-hmm. And I've had nightmares in the past where I've done work with them, but with this, there's no real memory of what's going on. Not much, anyway.
Right. You know, a lot of there's a lot of interesting work being done on women's dreams, particularly around menopause, because there's so many chemical changes. Mm-hmm. And just the hormonal balance tends to have, if we are of a more sort of a sensitive constitution, constitutionally sensitive, then those changes can result in a higher frequency of nightmares. I mean, it's typically we have the most nightmares as children and young adults, teenagers, and then it tapers off, but there is this other peak, and I've spoken to a lot of women in particular that have had experienced that roughly between 40 and 60, somewhere in there. So, that's...
So, like, the physiological changes and things like that.
Well, what about sleep paralysis? Mm-hmm. I had that for a while.
Yeah.
In my earlier years, and that was really scary.
Yes.
And that's very different probably than a nightmare.
It is different, but it's similar to night terrors. Mm-hmm. Do people know what sleep paralysis is? Do you want to describe your experience?
You're basically in a deep sleep, and all of a sudden you wake up, but you're not completely awake. You're half asleep and half awake, but you're completely where you're at. And I could wiggle my toes and my fingers, and I couldn't break out of it. I couldn't go back to sleep to shake it off, and I couldn't break out of it in my gut. Mm-hmm. And it would be this fight. And sometimes it would go on for 2 minutes, sometimes it would be like, this is 2 hours.
Could you breathe during that?
When I finally broke out of it, I would sit up in bed, and my head felt like it had bricks.
Yeah.
And I would just try to go back to sleep.
Was there ever a sense of a presence in the room? Some people report that.
Sometimes I would feel something hop onto the bed. Uh-huh. I could feel, sometimes I'd heavily hallucinate and kind of move things around the room.
Yeah.
Or something would be flying around, but it's hard to know really what's going on.
Well, that's all really consistent with sleep paralysis reports. So sleep paralysis is a funny thing. It's they call it a REM intrusion. You're awake. Your conscious mind is functioning, and then yet there's this REM intrusion, which means that you're actually dreaming at the same time. So So yeah, moving things around, things are slightly different. There's and the sense of paralysis, you can't quite get out of sleep. And you and there's a sense, sometimes people have a sense of something sitting on their chest.
That's never happened to me.
Yeah.
Is this physical paralysis?
It is a physical paralysis, yeah. And there's an excellent book by written by a friend of mine, Ryan Hurd, H-U-R-D. Do you know his book? Oh, it's fabulous. It's, see if I can remember it. Sleep paralysis, gosh darn it, I can't remember the subtitle. He started out as an e-book, and now it's actually in print, and you can get it at... but it talks about visions in the night and hypnagogia, which is that place right before, right as we're going to sleep, the hypnagogia. So all of these liminal states. And I think Ryan does an excellent job of, and this is where I've gotten most of my information, because his book was the first place where I really saw, I could see clearly the picture of sleep paralysis and how to get out of it if you were affected by it, but also to how to use it to get into lucid dreaming states, for instance. And he actually uses it as a trigger for out-of-body experiences. It's one of those things that I've never experienced sleep paralysis. I think some people are more inclined to it than others, just by constitution or whatever.
When she was explaining you're not having any memory, though, but...
No, but there's some similarities. Yeah. It's kind of like you're half in your body and half out or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're half present, but you're really not,
right.
You know?
Right.
And I think maybe astral projection, maybe she's flying out of her body somehow, and she comes back in and it's...
It can be jolting. Snapping right back in, jolting back in. Yeah.
That's all I want.
Did you find it interesting?
Exciting?
Or
doesn't sound like
your mind.
It's
did
very
I
fun.
Find it interesting?
Or terrifying?
Oh, terrifying.
Yeah. Totally terrifying. Having no control.
Yeah.
Being locked.
Ryan talks about the different ways to get out of it physically so that you can just have it stop. Which I think is a really important thing to... It sounds like you were able to manage, in some ways, getting through that and snapping out of it. But then he sort of turns the table on, okay, how can we make the most of this? If there's something here to be gained from this experience, what would that be? And how would we access that? And so he's one of the things that he talks about, how he had sleep paralysis from his teenage years on, and he talks about remembering somebody who he really loves, somebody who loves him beyond all reason, or who he loves beyond all reason, and just having that little anchor shifted the whole thing. He was able to then relax. He talks about just relaxing and not trying to fight it, and just breathing deeply if possible, but holding on to that image of just unconditional love. And then he was able to use the state of sleep paralysis as a way to go deeper into lucid dreaming. Because then you're relaxing in the state of both being awake and asleep, but you can actually move farther in whatever direction you feel called to go. But I thought that was really interesting to acknowledge both the terrifying aspects of it and the physiological, and it goes into a lot of the physiological explanations of it, but then also gets into these, you know, the spiritual possibilities of using the lucid dreaming or going into out of body experiences and so forth. So
I suggest that maybe there's some traumatic connection. I mean, because it sounds like you're talking about some early object relations.
Possibly.
Invasion or something.
Possibly.
Because if an unconditional love is somehow a door, then, you know, it's the relationship with the mother that usually is.
I don't have any idea, honestly. I can't. I mean, I don't.
I had a roommate who had it, and he didn't actually associate any imagery with it at all. Mm-hmm. It was simply, for him, it was simply, I mean, I observed it.
Yeah.
And only his eyes would move.
Yeah.
And he had no imagery. He just simply could not move.
Mm-hmm.
It was frustrating for him, but he just sort of waited it out, and it did. He knew it would, it would happen, and,
mm-hmm.
and it would last for, I think even up to 10 minutes.
Yeah. Knowing Ryan, my hunch would be, and not being a psychotherapist at all, but my hunch would be existential loneliness.
Yeah. Well,
that simply aloneness in the universe, and how does one regain connection to that?
What do you mean by that?
Just that feeling of I'm all alone and I'm trapped and I can't get out and there's nobody here. And that, he was commenting on the, if unconditional love is the anchor that gets you out of that, then it could be some object relations thing.
Yeah. It's kind of curious because one of the things that you were mentioned earlier, that nightmares tend to happen earlier on in life.
Yes.
I suffered from insomnia for ages in my early decades. I won't tell you how many. But I do recall very vividly my first decade in life, where the bed was positioned, the door to the room, there's the little bit of light, at my feet sort of thing. But I still to this day can remember bugs that were this big flying on my bed, and I sat up the night, or so mm-hmm. I thought, or think, mm-hmm.
right.
remember.
Right.
Now, I, at this point in my life, many decades later, I can't definitively mm-hmm. say that's what I was actually doing, but that's the vivid impression.
Right.
Those, to me, were nightmares.
Yeah, that sure
those were
like
scary, very vivid. Mm-hmm. They were real. Mm-hmm. They were very real. What I get nowadays in terms of imagery and dream states and places, and I know I've been in these places where I'm taking a nap and I'm aware of the room thing, but I'm also aware that I'm kind of sort of out of it. It's wonderful. That's a nice space. And there are these dreams, as I mentioned earlier. So I'd love to meet the screenwriter for this, these visions, because this guy is clever, but they're much more sedate.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, and I'm, I'm grateful for that
mm-hmm.
Relative to those.
Right.
So the question is that, were those really nightmares? Were those, is there something else going on, and what fuels that? How do we get away from that? That's what really brought me here tonight. I don't want any more of those to show up. But I also want to understand some of the stuff that's been coming up. Is it really a nightmare, or is it really just wonderful Hollywood?
Well, dreams are hard to generalize about, but I think that it makes sense in the big picture if you think about adolescence and just all the tumultuous change and going into early adulthood, and suddenly there's this huge transition that's to from being a kid to suddenly, I'm on my own. That tends to really ignite a lot of nightmares.
Not to mention hormones.
Well, yeah. Again, with the hormonal connection. So, it's tremendously complex. But I think, and little kids tend to have them too. So just the whole idea of going to school, for instance, 4 and 5 and 6 years old, big time for nightmares. So, growing up stuff. And I think any time of real change.
I was just wondering. My sense is that our wounds speak to us through, or wounds are looking for their opportunity to resolve themselves. In our sleeping as well as in our waking, and so they conjure up these images and just by confronting them, they give us an opportunity to heal wounds. But I was just thinking also that there are opportunities to grow. Like, I don't have scary dreams anymore. But when I was a child, lots of overwhelming fears, and so in dreams you're given opportunities mm-hmm. to face images that show you the fear, and mm-hmm. and so you can confront it and at least experience it in some way.
That would be where lucid dreaming
yes.
would play a part.
That's right.
Can sort of control or direct mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. winnow out parts of this mm-hmm. and come face to face with it and know that you're dreaming.
That's right. And the real key, this is sort of jumping ahead, because my core belief about nightmares, using them for in a spiritual sense, is that they help us develop courage. Mm-hmm. And that
confronting
or simply turning to face what is pursuing us in any sense is a tremendous act of courage. And you know, we deal with that in life all the time. Like, I don't want to deal with that person. Yeah. But in dreams, it becomes more stark somehow. You know, the detritus and the distractions fall away, and sometimes it's just me and the other, capital O. And so what do I do in that situation?
Monster.
Yeah, the monster, the pursuer, the whatever that is. So, yes, absolutely, turning to face. And I mean, there's a lot to say about that, but yes.
I had a bunch of dreams probably when I was in my late 20s. And mm-hmm. I was able to confront, you know, what it was and invited mm-hmm. me in. And so but this stuff is like, what's happening now? I mean, I wasn't screaming at first. Mm-hmm. I actually worked on that in the dream mm-hmm. so that I could yell, so that
right.
someone, you know, so my husband would hear me.
Right.
And I still do that. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. I'm like sort of working on that to get the sound out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, no, but this seems really different than that.
Yeah.
There's nothing to confront because I don't actually see anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there might be something, but
mm-hmm. it's more of a felt sense, or
yeah.
is there color associated with it, or sound at all? Or?
No, it's just mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of there's violence and there's yeah. you know, a lot of things going on mm-hmm. that I never really mm-hmm. know specifically.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be irresponsible talking
no.
about this, because there's so many, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of what to say, I'm thinking of all the caveats to what I could say, and because I think that there's, well, let's just take, for instance, I mean, a lot of people who have suffered trauma and abuse, PTSD, or any sort of survivors of whatever kind of abuse, have a lot of nightmares. And in those nightmares, it's really important to not just say, oh, I need to face or accept my pursuer. Actually, the most important thing is to draw boundaries first,
mm-hmm.
to be able to say no, or to lock the door,
right.
or to, you know, kill, if necessary,
yeah.
the dream image. So there's different levels at which the stuff is true about dreams.
Right.
So, I mean, if we don't have the psychic boundaries and defenses around us, there's not really a container within which we can explore any sort of communing or dialogue
mm-hmm.
with a dream figure. So I mean, I would always mm-hmm. Make sure that the foundations are in place. It's kind of like, it's almost like, I know Maslow's hierarchy is out of favor right now, but I really like it, because you know, you got to make sure that you're not going to die, right? You got to make sure that you're going
to
be okay, and then okay, now I've got the space to actually
mm-hmm.
delve into this stuff. Yes.
You started actually, I think, answer the question that the title of the book goes
yes.
into in that last bit of the thing. But what struck me was, is an illusion.
setting boundaries, we can do that in our conscious mind. Now we're awake, we're functioning, as opposed to in the dream state. But and that's where I thought I wasn't quite sure where you were describing to around, you know, setting the boundaries, you know, instead of killing your attacker or something, or facing them, or, you know, and using that as the illustration of other issues that might be going on, or imagery that's coming up. Mm-hmm. What do we do when dreams go bad?
Right.
I mean, you know, really, that's, the, you know, is there like a checklist? Please help.
There is. Actually, there is. And it's so well priced.
Oh,
$8. How can you lose?
Very good.
The obvious answer to, or the general answer to that is you do whatever you can think of to do. And that's where the recurring dreams come, because if, for instance, snake dreams. Anybody ever have snake dreams?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm one of those.
Before glasses.
I probably had about a decade and a half, possibly probably more like 2 decades, full of recurring snake dreams. And in those dreams, I tried every idea I could to, like, oh, here's another snake dream. Now what do I do? Do I kill the snake? Do I cage the snake? Do I let the snake bite me? Do I try and befriend the snake? Do I, you know, on and on and on and on and on? Do I let the snake eat me? You know, blah, 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 blah.
Are you able to have those decisions?
Yeah.
If you've been tormented by the same dream for long enough, yes.
So you found yourself actually having a mental process?
Having a mental process.
Deciding what to do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's really not a nightmare then, from my perspective.
No.
Because a nightmare is actually a loss of control. I don't have any.
This is no. It was a recurring nightmare, and it recurred long enough for me to begin to have a mental process of recognition in the dream state.
So you're sort of lucid dreaming then, at that point.
Recurring dreams actually can spur lucidity, because if you catch yourself thinking, oh my God, another snake dream, I can't say, and then suddenly you're lucid. Like, okay, right. Last time I had a snake dream, I did this, but that was a different sort of snake. So this time, if I have a snake, maybe I'll try this. So yes, it does become a lucid dream. But it was definitely a nightmare series. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What worked for you?
Good question. The shovel.
Well,
if you had them all, you'll figure it out later. Are they safe or not?
I doubt it.
I think it was really the last snake dream that I had. Somebody handed me this little snake that was just really mean, and I could tell it. All it wanted to do was just. It had one directive in its existence, and that was to bite me. And I was not going to let it bite me. And so a person handed it to me, and I grabbed it right behind the head. And I thought, I'm going to keep applying pressure here because I don't want it to let it bite me. And if it seems like it will stop biting me, then I will reduce pressure. But it never did. And so I just kept the end of the dream was I was just holding it like that, and, you know, with slightly increased pressure as it got madder and madder, and then I started to hear bones crunch, and that was the end of the dream. I mean, it wasn't a particularly enlightened dream, but it was the end of it. And but in the dream, there was no real affect. It was like, okay, here's the snake. I can be friends with the snake if it can be friends with me, but if not, I'm not going to let it hurt me. So it really was one of those boundary-setting things.
Mm-hmm. But it's good because you had it down to a really tiny snake.
It was a little one, that's right. It wasn't the enormous one coming out of the tree and devouring the whole hunting party. And every permutation of snake dream, I assure you. Oh, my goodness.
Did you ever surrender to the snake?
Oh, yes, several times. Yeah.
And what happened when you surrendered to it?
Oh, I got poisoned, I got eaten, I was stayed under the water for ages. I mean, different transformations happen. And you know, I had pretty much every snake transformation dream you could imagine. but I still had snake dreams.
You're a teacher.
Sounds very shallow.
Yeah, someday I'll have to. And I wrote them all down, all the ones that I could remember. So I'm gonna have to look through them. So that's.
I guess you know your totem animal.
Yeah, the mongoose.
The mongoose, really. Yeah. Boy, oh boy. Here's the good news and the bad news. Let's see. Kind of got off track, but that was actually probably a really illustrative sequence of dreams. I think, getting back to the gentleman I was talking with this morning, so here's a guy who spent his entire life in very erudite intellectual pursuits and asking really intelligent questions of essentially unknowable things. Why do we dream? Why do we have this dream now? And really at this point in his life, looking for answers, like, why haven't I been able to find it? I've read Aristotle, I've read Galen, I've read Empedocles, I've read all these people, and they all say these things, and I understand it, and I'm one of the few people who could talk chapter and verse about Augustine and all these people, and so why can't I understand dreams? And I think that's a really, it's a common misperception that we can understand dreams with our rational mind or our waking conscious mind. I think particularly in midlife, we tend to get to a place where our dreams, sometimes people have nightmares, like we were talking about women in menopause having nightmares. The dreams are coming to us and we cannot understand them in intellectual terms. They'll throw us these curveballs and have some set of symbols that is completely out of the ordinary for us. And to me, what that marks is the time at which we actually have to develop a somatic understanding of dreams and an energetic understanding of dreams. We have to somehow let the mind idle, you know, sit around in neutral while we develop these functions that are probably less fully developed in us. So that's where I like people like James Hillman talking about the animals in dreams, and just, you know, let the snake be a snake. Just don't try and analyze it, just sit with it. And lucid dreaming is ideal for this type of practice, where you don't say, you know, what are you, who are you, why are you here? You actually just feel in your body what that is like. And one exercise that I've given to clients of mine is to, when they don't understand a dream symbol, is to get into whatever sort of relaxed meditative state they are used to generating for themselves, and then bring the symbol really close, like it's a ball of energy, and like either holding it in their hands or it's sort of hovering over their body if they happen to be lying down. And don't try and do anything. Just feel the energy of that dream image and keep running energy through their body and see if there is a congruence somewhere. You know, see if, okay, right hip, somehow there is a congruence there. There's some energy in my right hip that feels like a version of what it is, this ball of energy in front of me. That type of stuff will lead to understandings of emotional states. And somehow, and energetic healings that don't really, it's hard to parse them into words. But I think that the more we can do that, the more we can open ourselves up to the interpretation of dreams that's not for our head to decide. It's more for our body to decide, or for our energy field to decide. I think that's really key. And I couldn't really say that to the gentleman on the phone. It would sound really insulting to him. But I actually think that that's a common misperception. And people have so much suffering around not being able to understand why that small little waist? I don't know. I would imagine holding that small waist. How would that feel to hold that small little waist? You know?
Well, one of the things that's occurring to me as we're talking is because I also resonated with Hillman talking about that.
Dream animals.
Yeah, dream animals. And what occurred to me at the time was that, because I spent a lot of time in the wilderness, I don't ask the question, why did this bear appear right now?
Yeah.
The bears are there in the wilderness.
Why this bear now?
in the dream is the same, in a sense is the same thing. When you enter sleep, you have entered a kind of wilderness.
Yeah.
And there you meet things. Mm-hmm. And for us to say that we need to analyze them and to interpret them is to favor this waking life over the dream life and to pretend that that is somehow some kind of thing that we can look at as though it weren't real experience somehow.
Right.
And I think that's what Hillman was basically saying. And I think it's very valuable to at least to shed light on the fact that we favor this rational waking life over the dream life. And there's lots of cultures that favor dream life over waking life.
That's
and of course they, you know, some of the results of that in their lives is pretty horrifying to us, but that's the way they lived.
Right.
You know, I mean, they lived in a very, what we would say, very irrational way.
Right.
According to dreams. And that's what this guy is confronting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, he was confronting actually a lot of people in those times who lived their lives by the dream, as I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Some of classical.
That's right. Some of that was really,
to not do that would be a disrespect.
That's right.
Dream life,
so. That's right. And at that time period, the same question and the same fear around dreams that was in Inception earlier this year, that's now coming out on DVD, are dreams true or false? That was a huge question in antiquity. How can you tell if a dream is a true dream or a misleading dream? And there's all sorts of
kings had hired guys and paid them a lot of money and stuff to interpret their dreams for them because that's how they were going to guide them.
Yeah, that's right.
So better get it right.
Yeah, that's right. So you got one chance.
Aren't there Aboriginal tribes, or perhaps not Aboriginal, who consult their dream? They get together in a circle and they discuss their dreams regularly.
Oh, all the time. And not just Aboriginal tribes. I mean, I think tribal peoples who are still on their land, there's a lot of tribes in Africa that still have a very strong tradition of dream interpretation. And it's quite striking, actually. And they're not necessarily living in the real Aboriginal way. You know, these are villages that are at least 20th century villages, if not 21st at this point. But yeah, there's families that have that sort of transmission through the family of interpreting dreams, and there's the rituals that you do if you have a dream that has a little bit of an ill omen to it.
So are they healthier for this and not irrational after all?
What, so I'm going to judge? Now we're in trouble.
I'm going to use a loaded word.
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know. The interesting thing, I was talking to a friend of mine from Senegal whose grandfather was a dream interpreter. And people would come from miles around to ask him what his dream meant. And he was talking about Senegal in particular. And there was a guy who was a tribal elder who had a dream that said, everybody in Senegal has to do X. And I can't remember. I think it was just sort of pour salt out the left side of your house on this day or that day to overcome this sort of national curse. It was sort of a national ill omen that he had dreamed about. And so he got on the radio and said, everybody do this. And many, many people did that. Now, did that help? I don't know. I mean, I'm a little ambivalent about folks like Robert Moss, who's a colleague of mine, who talks about we just need to actually live by our dreams. because you know, this country almost fell into a theocracy just 2 years ago. And having somebody who's an expert at dreams say, this means that everybody in the country should do X because there's this ill omen, I actually don't want to live in that country, you know? So it's a give and take. I mean, there's amazing wisdom and a tremendous fount of knowledge in all of these cultures. And I'm one of those people that believe we should listen to our dreams, but should a dream be an absolute authority? I don't think so. I don't know. I'm uneasy about that. And there are some dream workers who would go that far, and I'm not one of them, actually. I'm a little skeptical about the whole.
What about the epiphany dreams, then?
Yes.
And the woman you were talking about.
Yes.
Who had given the very clear direction yes. that she was to drop everything in her life and That's go back right. to school and,
yeah.
and get a
yeah.
degree in journalism and mm-hmm. pursue that.
I mean, my response to Professor Harris this morning was like, he was saying nobody has epiphany dreams anymore, and my response is, how many epiphany dreams can one person handle? I think one or two per life is plenty. You know, I don't want to have epiphany dreams because, yeah, I don't want to uproot everything and move to Vancouver and go to journalism school.
A lot of brake squealing.
Excuse me, do I get a say? So, I mean, I think he appreciated that. But, I mean, Carrie Nation had an epiphany dream that drove her to her... in her zeal to smash all the bars and saloons in the nation, and the temperance movement came out of her dream that was her mission from God.
But you know, it seems like it's different if you get a clear thing about yourself, but like what you were talking about with that, you know, that, I mean, that's one thing, but then getting another
yeah.
dream where you're telling other people what to
yeah.
do,
yeah.
you know, it, like a whole country or a whole, you know, that's
well,
different.
Religions are founded on.
That's right. Joseph Smith, famous
Epiphany
dream.
John
Brown. Yes.
Well, part of what we're starting to talk about, but it, you know, kind of comes to the same thing, and you made mention of the ancients. Earlier mm-hmm. on in your discussion and what they meant and such. My question would be, how does mind-altering elements influence our dreams?
Mm.
You know, alcohol, the mushrooms,
electromagnetic fields.
Well, yeah, we go to those. I'm thinking, you know, something I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. You know, eat it.
Well,
and you get these dreams and you get these visions mm-hmm. and there's lasting effects
mm-hmm.
for a period as it evolves, you know, or diminishes in our system. You know, what, you know, those are perhaps altered moments, but there are images that come out of those.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that affect certainly history, speaking to your earlier comment, but where we are now, you know, what we're doing with ourselves, and because like the Native Americans, they peyote, that was a very strong religious, spiritual, mm-hmm. I misspoke, religious is not the right word, spiritual aspect mm-hmm. of their being that they, you know, to take that and use that as guidance. You know, that's not really a, perhaps not dreams, but there's
waking
visions.
Dream state
waking dreams.
Perhaps?
Well, I mean, there's some people who would say that dreams and visions are all in the same continuum. Dreams, visions, active imagination, for instance, Deirdre Barrett, who's written a great book on dreams and trauma, says that. That's been her experience in... that's her story and she's sticking to it. There's others who would say, oh no, if you hook up the brain to EEGs and all that, there's different, very different between having a dream and having a vision or an active imagination episode. So, I mean, I don't want to get into the thing of, it's a little bit too broad of a question for the rest of the evening here.
Yeah.
But, what I will say, getting back to epiphany dreams, that they are similar to nightmares in that we take them as literal truth. If we have a really scary nightmare, it's really hard to imagine that, oh, this is symbolic. There's a metaphor in here somewhere.
You mean in the dream itself or afterwards?
Afterwards. We wake up from the dream and think, somebody was just choking me, or I was just seeing a friend die, or something horrible has happened. It's very hard not to just pick up the phone and call that person right away. Hmm. Are you okay? And there's absolute value to that.
Stay away from water.
But one of the things that I mentioned in my book is the importance of attending to the literal aspect of the dream, but also holding that there's more than one level of meaning in the dream. And I think that's key for dealing with epiphany dreams as well. I think when we have a dream or a vision that we know what's best for our town or the person next door or our children or, whatever it is.
I would not trust.
Okay. There's flavor crystals of truth in that. And there's also a way I think the great gift of the last 150 years of Western thought in terms of dreams has been this idea that there's an internal reality. There's a set of symbols and associations within each of us. And in that realm, this dream is also telling us something about ourselves. As much as we think that this is a dream that's very outer projected, that's about the collective, there's also an aspect that has to do with ourselves. And I think that's where, when people have these sort of grandiose visions and start, smashing people's places of business because God told them to do so. Okay, they kind of need a dose of the other side of that. And I think, my friend from Senegal is not really interested in that at all. Because it makes sense. He has a whole family and a whole village that interprets his dreams as things to do and things to literally do. I think we here in the West have a lot to learn from that because I think that dream interpretation has over-internalized our dreams. We sometimes don't ask the practical questions like, you had a dream that your car crashed. Have you checked the brakes lately? We have to really actually acknowledge that dreams sometimes have absolutely literal, this is not a metaphor, you really need to check this out, truth in them. So it's a both and kind of a thing, and that does not make for an easy. Therefore, it's a little bit more complex than people would like to imagine when you get into the whole fortune telling aspect of, ooh, tell me what my dream means. Well, maybe you don't want to know. I don't know.
It's interesting how much though when you think of it, our culture, the American dream. And the president talks about the American dream all the time, and all presidents do. And yet, it's not thought of as a dream. It's always been curious to me.
Yeah. Well, it is absolutely a dream in the larger sense. Mm-hmm. My show, Dream Talk Radio, the tagline of it is "Culture, Consciousness, and Dreams of the Future." Because culture has it's the cultural dream, the American dream. We all are affected by that. It's a group think that has guided our history for X amount of years. So that is sort of a larger shared dream. There's just layers upon layers of stuff there.
Martin Luther King,
I Have a Dream. Yeah. How are we doing for time, Jim? I've lost.
8:35.
Oh, it's 8:35. Okay, so
we're having such a good time.
I'm having a great time. I still have some tea left too, so you're gonna have to bear with me. Let's see.
Somebody's not sleeping tonight.
Actually, this was great. I covered much of what I really felt I wanted to say about dreams. Let me take a little moment here. Let's see if there's anything that I have not touched on. Uh-huh. I got to most of it. The one thing that I did want to talk about was ways to enter dreams. mentioned the meditative, very slow meditation of holding one dream image, kind of suspended animation, and just breathing into that and letting that, letting a body sense, a somatic sense arise, whatever that may be. Another thing that I've helped people with is dream reentry. Some people are much more visual. Some people have an easier time imagining things. Others are much more kinesthetic learners, and for them, the very slow sort of body center practice is really great. But for people who can drop into a dream reentry, you know, you can drop into a visualization. It's really handy to be able to, if you have a dream, a nightmare that you actually want to re-script and spend a little time with the figures, get a little bit more information. If you're skilled at lucid dreaming, of course, you can just sort of summon up the dream again and then go right into it as you're dreaming. But for those of us who are not quite as skilled at that, being able to get into a very relaxed state and then see the dream and sort of imagine a place before the action comes that you want to take a closer look at really helps. If you can somehow imagine yourself at kind of the antechamber to the main dream action, it's like the little waiting room. and I tell people this is a very 20th century, 21st century thing, but to feel like they have a little a remote control in their hand. So what you don't want to do is just speed through the dream and not say what you have to say or not do what you wanted to do, and then you think, oh, the dream's over. I didn't do what I, you know, and you feel bad about that. So really it's your imagination. So you can actually freeze frame. What I would do in this type of dream re-entry is to pay very close attention to my own emotional state, not just because if I get too flustered or something, I'm going to tend to come out of the relaxed state. So I want to stay relaxed, but I also want to notice my own reaction to replaying the dream. And to be able to do that, if I have something that I want to say to a figure in my dream, a question I want to ask, I will slow down the action very slowly as the dream is replaying in my mind and I'm coming closer to that moment. Slow it down and even maybe pause to just make sure that in my imagined version of this dream, I am actually coming from a pretty centered spot, as centered as I can, and being able to say what I have to say or ask my question in a way where I'm bringing all as much of my presence forward into that as I can. And then just being able to pause. Sometimes when we get to these places in a visualization, we tend to sort of our mind starts getting the you know, moving to the fore again. So being able to stay really relaxed and letting, if it's not a visual or an audio answer come, paying attention to our felt sense, emotional state, body energetic state, and letting that information come up more than relying on an actual physical conversation. So there's these layers of subtlety to the practice, but that's a really nice way to come to some sort of resolution, or at least shift the game forward somewhat. If this is a recurring dream, you can sort of, okay, now I get this. And usually the dream image has some profound insight for us. That act of witnessing and facing whatever image that is, that something happens. And there's a gift in there for us. So finding that gift and then moving on. And often that's the end of that dream. If we can really work through that in waking, the dream shifts and changes. Sometimes people have had the same elements in the dream, but different. For instance, if it's a huge if it's a huge mastodon that's chasing them and has them cornered and they deal with that, the next dream will be sort of this, you know, elephant on parade with the beautiful, you know, Indian, you know, jeweled, bejeweled thing. So there's a little bit of a dialing down of the tension of the dream.
Is it possible, as you're in that state between waking and sleep, to focus an intention in your mind on wanting to have a lucid dream, telling yourself that tonight when I sleep I will have a lucid dream, I will be lucid in my dream? And is the intention enough to carry that?
Yes. For some people it's easy to do that, and other people it requires more persistence. Just keeping trying every night, having that intention. Yeah. And the interesting thing is if you're, I'm asking, I'm actually moving on to another question, but a lot of people will ask for a dream in that way, like intending to ask for dream guidance about whatever issue that is. And sometimes when you get the answer, it's sort of jumbled and a little bit, like, how can this possibly, this doesn't really seem like, it's always important to actually write that stuff down, even if it doesn't make much sense. Because there's something in there, sort of a whole nother topic of dream incubation, but yes.
You recommend dream journaling?
I do. Although, if you're not a writer, per se, you just have a little one of those little recording devices.
Just say it.
Yeah, that really helps.
Do you have other books?
This is the only book I've published on dreams. So far. I have a blog, though. AnnHill.org is my website, and I write about dreams, and I write on the Huffington Post about dreams. I also am a columnist for Sage Women magazine, so every quarter I write about dreams and dreams and fill in the blank, sort of depending on what I feel like writing. I think that we've got closing announcements.
We do.
Thank you so much for coming. This has been really fun.
Thank you on behalf of Many Rivers for coming. So I just want to make note of the fact that we have a donation bowl on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute to it, which donations we split with our speakers to support their work, and the other half to support this space and keep it here for this sort of event in the future. I also want to point out that in addition to Anne's books, we have a few other books to look at, and encourage you to check out those on your way out. And thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to see you. You're a very articulate woman.
Thank you very much.
I admire the way you think on your feet and express yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you came.
I really enjoyed it.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, I'm sorry. Certainly one of the more entertaining speakers. You know, in terms of an interactive experience. And certainly something I can actually relate to in a meaningful and meaningful way. Mm-hmm. Certainly we just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
You know, that really became apparent, but it was fun scratching.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you coming out. Well,
thank you very much.
I have a friend to be influenced by something that was known.
So those are the things that she loves to do. And so if she was starving, she would probably say, oh, there's something that I have.
There's this familiarity and a sense of being at home.
Familiar with John Sanford.
It's a way of
remembering it. He favors active imagination. I guess Jung also.